reorganization, streamlining, clarification. E is the comparison of all of the changes that came in. There was two external changes that were suggested, and then we internally, during our reviews, found some changes that we are also proposing that wasn't in the notice of rulemaking, and those are highlighted. E, you also have the actual comment that was received, is also titled E. And then F is the statutory crosswalk that outlines the statutes and rules that also include the minimum standard rules that you all revised about a year ago. And then finally, G is the end result if you all approve the rules today with the current changes. So that's the documents. And so we've worked on this for over 16 months with the transportation community statewide. We have a transportation advisory council that is 9 regions of the state, 2 representatives per region. Right now we have 3 vacancies, so it's 15 people across the state. We held 8 meetings with the transportation advisory committee, going over in detail, that had wonderful conversations with them. And then they in turn went and held regions, each of them in their regions, of all of their districts within their regions. So 2 separate meetings. So we had lots of great dialogue throughout the past several months. We also engaged the Department of Revenue and their CDL experts, Colorado State Patrol. We have a wonderful representative that's partnered with us to make sure that we're addressing things from the State Patrol's aspect. The Colorado Association of Pupil Transportation Associations, they've been really wonderfully engaged with us. CDOT related to a couple of the rules, RTD related to that, and our Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration. So we've gotten a lot of stakeholders involved. The number one goal was to keep safety. Kids' safety is utmost importance, and we didn't want to dilute that in any ways. And so we made sure we didn't do that, but we also wanted to reduce regulatory burdens whenever possible. And I think we've, in little ways, done that to very successfully. We've strengthened or clarified some of the safety to make sure that, you know, safety is of utmost, and we're doing that, but again, without burdening the districts. So we're reducing the regulations. We'll have these resource guides that'll be helpful, we think. Reorganizing them to make them better. So some of the reduced regulations that we've accomplished through these proposed rules, we're eliminating accident reporting by the districts, because that's currently already goes to the Department of Revenue, who hands it off to the Department of Transportation, who does a lot of effort to scrub that data, fill in any gaps, make sure it's accurate. They are willing to share that data with us. So why fill out a form that's already available to us in a better way? We can get rid of districts doing administrative work. We can get rid of administrative work. And then we can do what we should be doing with that data, is really spending the time analyzing it. What's happening with accidents? What could we do with rule changes? What can we do with training? You know, what can we do to help avoid those accidents? So accomplishing the same goal with less regulation, or less administrative paperwork. Another one that we had lots of discussion about, this changing the minimum age for a school bus driver from 21 to 18. Many of our districts think, no, it should be 21, we don't want to go any lower. But they recognize that some of the districts, especially in the rural districts, who are having troubles getting drivers, as many school districts are, some of them might want that opportunity to hire a 20-year-old. And we even heard examples of saying, well, I know a kid who lives on that ranch that I would hire in a heartbeat, because he or she has been driving, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of equipment every day for many, many years, and it's reliable, and they would love to be able to hire those. So this allows that option, but does not change it at all if you don't want to. And so many don't want to change it and won't, but it allows that door for any district that does. We are also changing a requirement from a first aid certificate to just training, which may seem like just semantics, but a certificate costs $30, $40 per driver, and that includes small vehicle drivers, so the training aspect is much easier for districts, and they thought that was an important change. Other things, allowing an inspector to bring his own equipment if the inspection site at a district doesn't have it. Again, a little thing, but it can help some districts in a little bit. So a lot of those different things, that small changes that we hope to add up to a lot. So I can answer any questions that you have in regards to these.
Questions from members of the board? Yes, Ms. Rankin.
This is a really important issue to me because of the large geographical area of my district, and I had a lot of questions, and I have to tell you, I did read it all, and I called Jennifer, and she went through all the details and answered my questions, and I really appreciate that. But I am in one of those districts where you have 18-year-olds at the end of the line, and they can pick up two or three students on the way in, which is extremely helpful. I also have Grand Junction and Pueblo, which has a whole different situation. So I really felt this addressed everything, and I like the groups that you brought together because CDOT was a concern of mine. I still have the one question of the parents coming over New Mexico lines to bring their students to the bus stop that then drives them another 45 minutes to get to the school. And the safety issue there is still a concern. You don't have to tell me now, but I would like the answer to that.
Okay. All right, further questions? Yes, Dr.
So I think your goal was to put less responsibility on the school districts, but I have to tell you that I only ran this across a few moms, but the 18 to 21 thing was not very popular, so it seems to me we might need something in there. I mean, how many states have kids 18 driving buses? Is that a generally accepted?
I'd have to get more specifics. I don't know how many states do that. One of our discussion items on that was in order to get a commercial driver's license at the national level, you have to be 21. But states, so that's for interstate commerce. But with intrastate commerce, states have the ability to go to 18. Colorado is one of those states that allows CDL licenses to be 18 for intrastate. And so this would match the current CDL because you need a CDL to drive a bus, a big bus. And so I don't know that specific, but that was one of the things to say, well, let's be consistent with CDL regulations within the state of Colorado.
But I'm wondering if parents shouldn't know. I mean, I'm not usually the one that brings forward parents, but a couple of parents that I did mention this to, because I was shocked when I read it myself. I have a personal experience of being on a school bus on a long trip with high school students, and it got out of hand when they stopped for snack. And so there has to be a sense of authority on the part of the bus driver if it turns out that there isn't a teacher along. So I'm weighing the reality of the rural area where kids have been driving since they were 12, and the tremendous responsibility that we're giving to a young person with, I don't know how many kids are on a bus, and depending on the ages of what a challenge that could be, and do we want to notify our parents, or in what way do we make sure that this is a really transparent change?
My understanding is a number of school districts that voiced concerns and discussions in this, many of those districts have that as a board policy right now. And so in order to change it, they would have to go through a change to their board policy, which would be done through the local school board and would go through the open meetings process. So I do believe that if any district were to change, they would go through that process.
So the district policies have incorporated what the rules have been? Is that how that works?
That is my understanding, and I know that we have at least one person here to testify at the second hearing, but So I think she might be a great resource. She's been around for a long time and knows a lot, not only in her district, but other districts.
Yeah, I'm trying to get the connection between this change and the perceptions that might be out there. We hear people talking about not having kids drive at all until they're 8. I mean, we have this two different points of view right now about when are you a competent driver, at what age, at what brain development, all that stuff, and this looks like it's completely contrary to that notion. The other one that I wondered about, having been in a district where there was a horrible mountain accident, what is the part about eliminating the written tests? Why would that be a good idea?
The reason that we did that, one of the Colorado state law requires all drivers of a pupil transportation vehicle, which would include a small vehicle. So if you have a sedan that you're going to take two or three kids to some event, that would also include those individuals, that they take adverse weather condition driving and mountainous driving. And so
the actual driving or a test or both?
The state law just requires the training, no tests associated with that. And so one of the things that that's still a requirement, we used to require it annually for all drivers. That was changed in these rules to say you no longer have to do it annually. One of the examples that we heard several times is, well, if I'm out on the Eastern Plains, I have two drivers that would ever go into the mountains. The rest of my drivers are only route and they never leave the Eastern Plains, yet I have to dedicate, an hour of training or how much of training every year for mountainous training when they're not going to be taking kids. And so that didn't seem like the best use of resources. And so it's still required that they get that every year, but they don't need to train every year on it. And then the test, we had a lot of discussion about what's the value of these tests. Are the tests really adding extra value to them or not? And many of them thought, no, the tests weren't really good. Many of the drivers are saying, yep, we're going to test any driver that goes into the mountains. We're going to still train them every year, but just not do the tests.
Yeah, you're not riding when you're going down the mountain.
I like to do the tests, and so they're going to still, and we'll work with them to keep providing tests if they'd like, but it's just not a requirement. Everybody really thought that it wasn't adding value, that the training is what's important.
So it does seem a lot like we're making things easier for districts, and I'm still a little bit worried about how to ensure. I mean, I don't see things in here that actually look safer in terms of the bus drivers. There might be vehicle maintenance issues that are safer, but in terms of this, I don't know that we've. Can you tell me what we've added to make driving safe,
safer? One of the things, when there's 6 hours of training that's required every year, I think if you can take off some stuff that is not applicable, like mountainous driving in that case, if you're never leaving to the mountains, then that frees up time to focus on other things. Some of the other specific training or to make it more safety, in 1205 we added in, currently it's you cannot use alcohol or use tobacco. We're clarifying that you cannot have alcohol either, even if you're not consuming it, you shouldn't be having it at all. But we also clarified marijuana and cannabis products for the drivers. We'd heard some districts were having more of a problem with that, some Southwest, and so we thought that was a good clarification, because even though it's maybe legal, or if you have a card, we don't want you possessing it or using it. There's still, we didn't change, you can't drive while under the influence, whether that's just being too tired or sick or any other reasons. So that hasn't changed. The drug and alcohol random testing hasn't changed for CDL drivers, and the reasonable suspicion is still there. What we have added or just clarified is some of the vehicle stuff, so to make sure that you can't drive in an unsafe manner. We also had provided clarification that districts can retest, do a new driving test, again, for any reason. You have to do it once a year, a driving test, but we clarified that you can retest if necessary. Some districts weren't sure that they could, and so, and it was also a signal to bus drivers that, yes, you can be retested if there's a reason for the district to want to retest you. So we've done some of those things.
Thank you.
Further questions? Dr. Scheffler.
My question is, do these rules change who oversees school transportation vehicles? In other words, I see references to the National School Transportation Specifications and Procedures Group. Does that imply that the nature of who oversees these transportation vehicles in Colorado has shifted in any way to some other organization that wasn't involved before, or is it just the same groups? Or can you speak to that?
Yes, it's the same group. So in addition to these two sets of rules that we're discussing today, there's the minimum standards rules, and so those are under the Colorado Department of Education and your rules about the vehicles and what the requirements of minimum standards are for those. And then these talk to the requirements to maintain and inspect those. But we also reference that it has to be the manufacturer's minimum standards for each bus, so they have to meet those.
So the regulatory oversight is the same as it was before?
It hasn't changed.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Hearing none, is there objection to the adoption? First of all, is there a motion on the rule? Okay. Just for the record, the first motion is to repeal the rules for the annual inspection and preservation of and preventative maintenance of school transportation vehicles. So,
Chairman?
Yes.
I think Dr. M is trying to.
Yes. Dr. M?
I just wondered if, do you call for testimony?
I was just about to say.
I think that's for the next rulemaking hearing, as I recall.
Thank you.
So, all right, is there objection to the, it's been moved and seconded that the motion to repeal these rules is, and then we'll reenact them in the next motion, I presume. Okay. Objection? Seeing none to the repeal of these rules. That motion is declared adopted by a vote of 7-0. We'll now proceed to 12.02, which conduct a public rulemaking hearing for the operation of school transportation vehicles. The board voted to approve the notice of rulemaking at its April 13, 2016 board meeting. A hearing to promulgate these rules was made known through publication of a public notice on April 25, 2016 through the Colorado Register and by the State Board notice on June 1, 2016. The State Board is authorized to promulgate these rules pursuant to 22-2-107 paren 1 paren C CRS. Commissioner, is the staff prepared to provide an overview?
I think they already have, but we'll...
we're hopeful on that account.
Continuing
great.
On great. The next step of this.
When, then, you have nothing additional to add, I take it, on the overview? Okay. Then we have Nancy Lutz signed up to testify. Ms. Lutz? From the Callahan School District. Just get close.
Hello?
Just close.
Well,
yeah. Change your singing.
As he said, I'm Nancy Lutz. I'm from Callahan School District. Callahan School District is a small rural district. We have approximately 450 students, preschool through 12th grade, all on one campus. I have been working for them for 35 years, driving a school bus, being the director, being the trainer. When you work in a small district, you wear lots of hats. I have been on the Transportation Advisory Council since its inception. We have spent almost 2 years working on this set of rules. Prior to that, we worked on the update of the minimum standards. This has been a wonderful process, actually, so much better than the way we used to do it, because we have input from people all around the state, and we go back to our regions, and we have regional meetings. People ask more questions. We come back together as a group, and we hammer those things out. I feel that this group of rules are simpler, easier to understand, and I believe it will be easier for people to be in compliance. And some of the things that Jennifer has discussed will also be money-saving and time-saving for districts. In the state of Colorado, I am known as the advocate for small school districts. I'm the small district mouth. I'm always saying, wait, you can't do those things. Small districts won't be able to comply. So there are some things in here that will absolutely save time and money for small school districts. So I feel that this is a good set of rules.
Okay, all right.
Any questions?
Very good, thank you very much. Okay. Appreciate your testimony, thank you. All right. Oh, it's 35 years now, she's new at the district.
And thank you for driving for testimony.
Yeah, let's, all right, is there a motion on these rules? Dr. Schroeder?
I don't want to make the motion because I'm going to vote against it.
If you're going to vote against, may I ask you to reconsider, because you've already repealed the one set of rules. This is the replacement rule, so we will have all right, no rules.
I'll just express my objection to 18-year-olds driving buses.
Okay.
I move to repeal the rules for the operation of the school transportation vehicle and reenact the rules with the amended rules for the operation, maintenance, and inspection of school transportation vehicles.
Is there a second? Yes. Ms. Rankin seconds, and you're going to hold it. You know, and she's going to hold this against me, but you wouldn't want no rules for the next 30 days. Yeah, a little procedural issue there, gotcha. All right, is there objection to the adoption of that motion? Seeing none, that motion is adopted by a vote of 7-0, and we now have the rules in place. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. If you want to reconsider, we'll go all the way back through and I'll vote to reconsider.
Then I'll be on
your ship. No, you won't. It's perfectly legitimate. Okay, we now have 13.01. The, let's see, the BEST program grant awards, if I can find it. So, let's see here. Would you care to make a motion on that one?
Sure.
Dr. Schroeder.
I move to approve the award of projects on the attached fiscal year 2016-17 BEST grant list for the award amounts, matching contribution amounts, and types of funding as set forth in the published agenda and to direct the Division of Public School Capital Complex Construction to award the approved fiscal year 2016-17 BEST cash grants.
Is there a second to that motion? Ms. Rankin seconds the motion. Let's see. Commissioner, would staff prepare to would provide a quick overview, please?
Sure. Who's this going to?
Kevin Huber and Scott Newell.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Right.
I'm new at this. I'm just learning.
Thank you, Kevin Huber, Division of Capital Construction. The list you have in front of you is the product of our last year's worth of work, and for our applicants, even longer than that. We opened our grant application January through February of this year, and then in March and April, we work with our districts, help clarify anything with the grant application, get the budgets in line, make sure we have everything ready to go. And then at our April board meeting, we present our Capital Construction Assistance Board with this book. Happens to be over 500 pages this year. It includes all the information from the 53 grant applications we got. Those 53 applications totaled over $250 million in requests for capital needs. Our board then gets another book with that, and you guys just got an evaluation sheet. Another 240-page book that has an evaluation sheet for each grant applicant in there. And then they have the next month to review all of the applications and then score them. That evaluation sheet that you're looking at stemmed from a 2013 performance audit from the state auditor's office and has been approved by them in evaluating our grant applications. So our board reviews all the grant applications for a month, fills out the majority of it. They will have some clarifying questions at the meeting. And we held our meeting on May 24th and 25th of this year, two-day meeting. All of our applicants got to come and present to the board, and then our board asked them any clarifying questions, finished filling out their individual evaluation sheets, and then staff takes those sheets and I input them into a spreadsheet, and we average the score of all of the sheets for each applicant. First, by, if you look at the sheet, by the statutory criteria that we're mandated to use, priority one, health and safety, and then priority two, down the list. So first we sort all the applications by their priority, and as of over the last 8 years, we've never made it below priority one. Then we take all the scores and average those out and make a list. And then we draw a line in the funding we have available to give away. And so for the state portion, you see that's $60 million is what we were appropriated this year. And we were able to hit that mark. You see the list of backup projects on there. Up above in the 31 awarded applications, you have a lot of schools going for bond elections this year, capital campaign. They're getting ready to start. And so if any of those failed, we didn't want to leave any money on the table and make sure that we're fully utilizing that $60 million. And so if you guys have any questions about the process or the list, we would be happy to answer them for you.
Questions from members of the board? Ms. Masnick.
I'm sure you're aware. We are hearing some concern that the BEST board is not giving enough attention to the charter school applications or is not treating them fairly. We have 12% of students in charter schools, and they're getting 0.2% of the BEST grants. Do you care to comment?
I would, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
Lyndon Burnett. I'm chair of the Capital Construction Assistance Board. I just saw this information this morning, actually, and all the letters and stuff from the Charter League. When we get this flash and all the combination of all nine board members, this year we had eight because one of our board members didn't get approved through the legislature at the last minute and wasn't on the board officially. So we had eight people doing this. I know what I did on my sheet, and I was very surprised when I saw that. This year was an exceptional year. Charter schools did a much better job of their applications, but so did public schools. Most years I have many, many projects. I don't even recommend to go to the short list because they're so poorly written. They don't meet the requirements and everything else. I don't think there were two or three out of all the districts that applied this year that I didn't recommend to the short list. I think it speaks to the quality of the people in our office, our division staff, the fact that charter schools and public schools are coming in and finally, after all these years, asking our staff, what are they looking for? What do we need to have? What kind of master planning needs to go into this? What do we have to do to prove that this project is worthy? And it was very close. I've never had my grades in such a tight range, and I thought we're going to have a lot of ties if everybody else looked at this the way I did. Actually, on my sheet, I thought we were going to have a lot of charters rise to the top. I thought they'd be getting a huge part of that. Unfortunately, as I said many times, it sucks not to be king, and I don't get to make that decision. It's all the board members' scores that go together, and when it just shows up, that's the way it is. The only comfort I take from this is that looking at this every year, we've had bond issues that fail, and we've got four or five that are dependent on that, and they're very large projects. We're going to get way down this sheet, I think, if even one or two of those bond issues fail next November, but we won't know till then. But it'll pick up a lot of charter projects that are just below there. There's one in here, I think, for $16 million. I thought it was an excellent application, but there were a number of others that I personally thought were well-deserving. So I was a little bit surprised. I don't think there's anything in the process that's punitive, nor do I think we can go in and look at it. And, you know, I don't even really try to look at that when I'm personally looking at my score sheet. I try to read the information. We do look at the amount because there is a limited money, but there's nothing in there that says you can't grant a certain amount. So the ranking is the ranking, and there's some things that I hope the board will look at better. I'll just say right now, and I thank y'all, this is my last year. I'm term limited. Y'all, this board has appointed me, your board, three different times to continue on here. And it's been a great learning process, and I've enjoyed the work. It's been very rewarding. So, but I am term limited this month, and so I won't be there, but I have offered to come back if they choose to do, you know, a board retreat to kind of discuss some of these issues and whatnot. I don't, you know, we have, there's a lot of information in those grants, previous grants, things like that, but those things aren't statutes, so I don't really let that affect how I score that thing. The other thing that gets in there a lot of times are you meeting your match. Personally, on my sheet, the maximum that I give that, if you meet their match, you get 8. If you meet more than your match, you get 9. If you get way more than your match, you get a 10. If you don't meet your match and there's a waiver request, I graded a 7. There's no other scores to me in that. They're very close, so nobody gets dinged a huge amount on that. But I think the process needs to recognize, are you making your match? That's what the, you know, the part of the program is. I don't know how everybody else does it, but in training and talking about it, we tell them, as long as you're true to whatever your rubric is on all 53 applications or whatever, you'll be fine. Just be consistent. And I hope that's happened. So.
Well, I would say that it was also another issue brought up, is that the process, the application process, the grant process is cumbersome. And I think that's probably true for almost all grants. They're competitive grants. They often can be cumbersome, and it's harder for charter schools to be able to get the assistance they need to write a good application, you know, not just time, resources to do it. So that was another complaint. And this is all probably maybe a discussion for the future of BEST going forward. But my concern is that it just doesn't seem to make sense that we have charter schools who have been applying, you know, and they're 12% of the population in Colorado, but they're not getting the grants from BEST.
Well, I think that's true this year. I would certainly agree with your statement. I think to the larger issue, and, you know, maybe I shouldn't even waste your time, I don't know that this whole grant process is right for the state. I don't know why the legislature doesn't tip $200 million a year into building schools or doing something instead of having a grant, because, I mean, where's the money out of, what, $12 billion or $9 billion or whatever we spend in this state every year? I don't know that this is the best answer, but I know it's the only thing we have right now. And the schools on the top of this list, we have a couple of water projects. One of them, the Department of Health's talking about $10,000 a day fines. I'm real glad to see it up at the top of the list. There's asbestos in here. There's structural problems. There's nobody on this list that doesn't need money. But everybody below that list needs it badly, too.
Excuse me, though. Did you say also that if bonds fail, then
if the bond fails, then the project doesn't go forward, and the funds that we were matching goes down the list? And like I said, I've never seen a year where all the bonds passed. They're all over the state in different political, different communities, different. I mean, a lot of the Western Slope schools here are having mines shut down and whatnot. I don't know, but I would think those people don't want to raise their taxes if the jobs are going out of their towns. I mean, I don't know, but I'm just saying in the past we've always seen that to be the case.
Well, thank you for your service. So you're doing your last hurrah here at the Pueblo meeting?
Yes, I am.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Further questions? So yes, Dr. Scheffel.
Yeah, I would echo that, too. Thanks for doing this work. It's hard to do when you have limited resources and lots of needs. We appreciate it. My question is also just about the procedural piece. Do you review the applications blind?
I'm sorry, do you review
them? Review the applications blind, so you white out the type of school it is, so you're just really looking at needs or...
No, we have a scoring rubric, and I think each section of there is about 40 points, one's 30, and you go through and there's line items that are lined up with the statute, and this was part of the audit we did that Kevin mentioned in 2013, how closely does this rubric reflect the legislation. So it's been all redesigned to kind of wait and make sure that we're staying in compliance with what the law requires. and he talked.
I don't think that was Dr. Sheffield's question. I think the question was, do you blind score these? That is,
so you don't know what kind of
you don't know which district or school is applying. That name would be scrubbed.
No, we know. We have all the information, the financial, what bonding already done in their community, or if they've never done a bond. We have all that information. Oh. Yes, sir. I'm sorry. I didn't understand your question.
Would be hard to conceal that. Yes.
I had a follow-up.
Yes, Dr. Sheffield.
So, and a lot of times, you know, in reading grants and such, that sometimes is a procedure that you can put in place if you have somebody preliminarily sort the information and then white out, delete the information that identifies what kind of school it is, for example. I don't know how hard that would be because I don't know how many data points you're dealing with, but, you know, in the future, maybe having some kind of process that created confidentiality of the nature of the school could create more level of playing field, just a thought. Another question is, when you look at the rubric, do you feel like there's words on here that would systematically disadvantage charters? And I don't know the answer. Sounds like you've aligned the rubric with the statute. But when you look at words like overcrowding, matching funds, leveraging available resources, as you reflect on how charters function, is it likely that they would have a harder time hitting a 10 in those categories as opposed to a traditional public school? And I don't know. I mean, is a charter likely to have an overcrowding issue? I don't know. But just a thought, when you see systematic, you know, groups disadvantaged in a process, then you look at the process and think, are there any ways that we could create more equity in the process? So I'm just raising issues that you could reflect on.
May I ask a question, too?
Let him answer this one, please.
And if you don't mind, I'll take that one, Mr. Chair. So Scott Newell, former director, this is my last hurrah as well. Each year, typically in July or August, we have a lessons learned meeting with the public. The division goes forward with observations they had, the board comes with theirs, and then we consider other things. So just the example used right now with leveraging other funds, that was actually changed last year to help benefit that process, because before we talked about specific things that might have been disadvantaging others. And so when we looked at leveraging now, and the way we talked to that is, other things you've done, if you've got in-kind services or you're doing other collaborative things with vendors and whatnot that help offset costs or create efficiencies in the project, and then our staff in sections identify those, so we felt it actually enhanced the playing field in some respects, because now you're looking at all the things they're doing to provide either cost efficiencies or additional funds or other services to the project that can get recognized and scored, as opposed to maybe how much do you contribute to a cap reserve, and maybe they don't per pupil anymore, but they're doing something else, and they should be rewarded for that. And yeah, every year we look at those and we say, how effective was this, or did it not provide the results that we were hoping they would, and try to change that.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Dr. Flores.
And my question was, do we fund charter schools? Do we fund buildings? Or was